Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with North Carolina-based veteran jazz trumpeter, composer, and arranger, Rich Willie. He opened up about his new 2022 CD, Putting on the Ritz. His trumpet and bass trumpet playing draw upon the wellspring of bebop with a contemporary freshness. He was active on the New York scene in the 1980s to the mid-90s, handling a wide range of Latin and jazz gigs, most notably backing up legendary vocalist The Velvet Fog, Mr. Mel Torme. He actually spent some quality time in Philadelphia prior to coming to New York City. We get into all of this and so much more. Enjoy this interview.
Hey, Rich, it's Joe.
Hey, man, how you doing?
Hey, good, man. How's life?
Life is great, man. No complaints.
Good.
Only things to be grateful for.
Cool, man. Well, hey, thanks for taking a minute out today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's an honor.
So the first thing I want to point out, and I want to get into, you know, you've had such a wonderful career. There's so much that's a part of it. But before we get into all of that, I want to know, how did you survive COVID? How did you make it through this time period as an artist? And how did it change you now that we're coming out of it?
Well, I mean, I really didn't do anything different. I started every day with prayer and meditation. You know, I was taught, if you worry, don't pray. If you pray, don't worry. And, you know, I got busy taking care of business. I had to cancel, like, an upcoming tour and some guest artist gigs. And I had some contracts for some gigs locally that they were bailing on me, and I was trying to fight it. But, you know, I finally just said, you know what, I'm supposed to be learning a lesson here. So, you know, this is really not the first time that my musical activities were, you know, quote-unquote interrupted. I've had, five or six times I've had, you know, injuries, illnesses, surgeries, you know, stupidity, whatever, and I've had to completely rebuild my trumpet chops from nothing, from ground zero. So I kind of learned a long time ago that there's really never any reason to panic. You know, I just look up, I say, what is the lesson I'm supposed to be learning here? And then I just get to work, you know, do whatever's in front of me. You know, I was in New York City on 9/11, and all my work dried up. I mean, you know, that's not the worst thing that happened to anybody. A lot of people died, but all my work just dried up. And like 3 days later, I got a call to go on tour with Maynard Ferguson, and, you know, that kind of rescued me momentarily. You know, they say when one door closes, another one opens up, and that's kind of what happened. And then when I got back to New York, you know, I still didn't have any work. I was really broke then. And then I had this heart, it wasn't exactly a heart attack, but I did have to have stents in January of 2002. And, you know, I had met this girl in North Carolina, and, you know, we were talking, and I decided to move to North Carolina because it's a lot cheaper to go broke here than in New York City, you know what I mean? And so I had started Baptism Music Publishing by then, and, you know, I focused on that and, you know, tried to get a teaching job. And, you know, I just, you know, kept looking, you know, keeping my nose to the grindstone. In fact, I had Trumpeter's Worst Nightmare, Bell's Palsy, in 2009. And, you know, rather than panic, I just got busy. I wrote another book, you know, which is on my website. But, so you're saying what's changed? I mean, well, since March of 2020, you know, I did one online gig, and I said, you know what, I don't think so, man. So I didn't do any online gigs. To me, that's, you know, I know a lot of people did. To me, it's a form of begging. You know, they have a fancy word for it, busking. I don't do that anymore. I actually had done that for a while in New York, and no, I don't do that. But since then, I wrote three more books. I made three of my trumpet books into trombone books. I started learning how to play EVI, the electronic valve instrument. I did have to have, it's my second rotator cuff surgery on my shoulder, so that was another, you know, long recuperation period. I was able to play tuba all that time because I have a stand for my tuba and I don't have to hold it. But, you know, I had to take a break on trumpet and bass trumpet. But, you know, and yeah, so I had to rebuild a trumpet embouchure yet again. I did practice trumpet, tuba, bass trumpet, EVI, as much as I could all, you know, the whole time. I wrote a ton of new tunes. Good grief, man. And I finished getting my Putting on the Ritz CD, you know, put together, assembled, mixed, And it's released now on CD, USB, and LP at baptism.com/store. Get that in there quick. And, you know, my wife and I did both get the virus in January of this year, and, you know, we both recovered, and, you know, now it's back to work. So we are totally done with it, and I have long since moved on. So there you go. Is that a good answer?
I like it. That's a great answer, man. You went through okay. a lot of places that I want to touch on. And the first thing is, you know, the new album has to feel relieving now that, you know, live gigs are picking up, the world's waking up. How does it feel?
Well, it was kind of a long time coming. Only one of the tunes on there is from the tunes that I wrote recently. My friend Carrie Dedman in Chicago, who's a brilliant arranger, fantastic trumpet player, producer, contractor, and he was my college roommate at North Texas State, you know, so we go way back. And I had sent him some mock-ups of these arrangements that I had, you know, I was learning how to use Pro Tools, and I sent them to him, and he's the world's busiest man. You try to get a call into him, it might take you 3 weeks. But anyway, he said, man, these arrangements, he said, we got to get these out. So, you know, his support means a lot to me because I respect him so much as just a brilliant musician. The tune Holy Trinity, I feel, to me, is the most special tune on the whole thing. And, of course, on the album release, it's the longest tune, 10 minutes and 45 seconds. We did put a radio edit version on the CD, which is, it only has one solo on it, which is John Swanna playing Evie. And anybody who doesn't know who John Swanna is, good grief, that guy is so monstrous. He and I go way back. But, I'm excited about the CD. I think, you know, it's there's nothing really challenging. You know, it's not real scientific jazz. I'm not a jazz scientist. I like music that feels good and sounds good. And, you know, you want to nod your head and smile and even laugh. Yeah, I love to laugh. I don't think there's anything on there that's, you know, terribly dissonant. Well, I know there's nothing on there that's terribly dissonant. So if you like to have fun and, you know, even dance and stuff like that, it's just good, positive, uplifting music.
I agree. I feel the same way about the album. And I'm looking forward to spending it on the show. But let's get to the beginnings of your life. How did these seeds of jazz get sprinkled? How did you start out on an instrument? What was your childhood like?
Well, I mean, I was born in 1955, so like the TV shows and commercials, you know, there's a lot of swing, like the Dick Van Dyke theme, you know, it's a big band. You know, I just heard jazz all the time. My parents really weren't into jazz, and I played in stage band, as we called it back then, from seventh grade on. You know, there was a guy in this adult stage band that met on Tuesday nights in Clearwater, Florida, which is where I grew up, this guy, Emery Cormier. You know, we would be playing these charts, and all of a sudden there were no notes. There were just these slashes and these, you know, funny cymbals. And this guy would make music out of it. I remember thinking, wow, how did he do that? And then after I graduated high school, I was at a buddy's house, and he's playing this album, Super Sax Plays Bird. And I'm listening to it, and I said, wow, I said, who wrote those sax solis? You know, I knew what a sax soli was. And he handed me the album and said, here, read this. And I read the liner notes and I see that these are improvised solos by this guy named Charlie Parker. And somebody wrote them out for, I guess, five saxophones. And I was just stupefied. I said, good grief, man. It's time for me to buckle down and learn this stuff. So I got into Charlie Parker first. And I went through a long period, what I call it my flying blind period, where I didn't know anything about chords, man. I knew that chords were the answer, you know, understanding chords and harmony, but I didn't know the right questions to ask or the right people. So when I did, after I got out of the Army, stumbling along through all of that, in 78, I went to North Texas State, and I say with Dan Hurley, Rich Madison, and Jack Peterson. And then I went to a Jamie Abersold clinic in January of 79 and studied theory with David Baker. And basically the on switch, you know, they taught me how to learn how to, you know, learn how to improvise. I don't think you can teach anybody how to improvise, but I think you can give people enough guidance so they can learn how to learn themselves. So So yeah, I was a late bloomer, and I'm definitely not the fastest learner. I may not be a slow learner, but I think I might be a fast forgetter. Anyway, yeah, it's been a process. Oh, and then I went to Philadelphia after I left North Texas State, and that was the best thing I could have done, because it was in 81 to 84. I lived in Philadelphia, and I got to play with, Hank Mobley, for crying out loud, Johnny Coles, Don Patterson, John Swanna, you know, a lot of cats in Philadelphia, man. And that was the perfect place to, by that time I had stopped playing trumpet. That was one of the times I had to stop playing trumpet. I was playing bass trumpet, you know, due to an injury. So, you know, playing a weird instrument in a new town. But the Philadelphia jazz, what do you want to call them? The elders, they were great. Bootsy Barnes. I mean, they were so good to me, man. They were so encouraging. Not like when I later went to New York, it's like they wanted to get you out of there. They didn't want you there. That's the way I felt anyway, when I finally did get to New York. Anyway, sorry, that was a long answer.
No, you're good. You're good. So you go to New York, you hook up with Mel Torme, and, you know, you already mentioned Hank Mobley. What did you learn from these legends and luminaries that you are around that you in turn have, you know, tried to teach younger players that you get around?
Well, let's see. Let's start with Mel. Because, you know, if you look through my record collection, you won't find many singers. And the only album that I had ever had of his was the Schubert Alley. And, you know, I was just, you know, singing lyrics never really, I don't hear lyrics. I hear melodies. I hear bass lines. You know, I hear chords. But so, you know, I get this gig on Mel Torme's band, and, you know, I'm pretty stupid at this time. And I realized, man, this guy's a real musician. You know, he conducted the rehearsals. He had written all the charts except for, there was a Duke Ellington chart, Rockin' in Rhythm, and then there was I think it was a Nestico chart, like one of the fast ones that he used for an opener. Everything else he had arranged, so he knew this stuff. And, you know, when he did the gig, he didn't want any reverb. He wanted his vocal mic to be totally dry. I mean, that's, you know, it's pretty ballsy, man. I was very impressed. Yeah, I gained a lot of respect for him. You know, I listen for musicianship. I don't necessarily, you know, chops, you know, can disguise insecurity. You know, there's guys with fantastic chops who, you know what, after a couple solos, I'm done, man. I don't want to hear anymore. But, you know, he had this just, you know, he was a musician, man. He had musicianship, like, you know, oozing out of him. So I really respected that. Hank Mobley, he basically, you know, if I had really paid attention, taught me that, you know, booze and drugs are not the way to go, because he was kind of a shell of a man by the time I ran into him. In fact, the first time I ran into him was in the streets, and I thought he was one of these, you know, escapees from Byberry, which is the state hospital there in Philadelphia. But he started showing up at jam sessions with this guy, Charlie Cunningham, who was kind of looking after him. And, you know, I got to play with him at several jam sessions, and then one time at a place called Natalie's at 40th and Market, I had showed up for the jam session that happened first, and then the pros played after that. Well, Johnny Coles was supposed to have been on the gig, and he wasn't there, so they asked me to stay and play. So I got to play the whole gig with Hank Mobley, and it was, you know, quite the, I mean, come on. He like I said, he's kind of a shell of a man, but he played old folks. I tell you what, man, it still almost makes me cry to think about just how beautiful. You know, talk about musicianship. That guy was 100% musician. Just, and the irony was, he was one of my idols when I was at North Texas. I was buying Hank Mobley albums when I moved to Philadelphia in 81. I went to Third Street Jazz, and I asked the guy, show me all your Hank Mobley, you know, as a sideman everywhere. And I got as much Hank Mobley as I could, because he spoke to me, man. So what did I learn from those guys? Just to respect, you know, incredible musicianship. That's, to me, that's really the, you know, I don't remember Hank double timing just for the sake of double timing and showing you that he could, you know what I mean? Very often he's just telling a story. To me, that's what it's all about, man, telling a story.
Well, you know, you've been at this game for a long time, and I'm curious, what is it that fueled your longevity? What is it that you look forward to every day when you wake up as a professional musician?
Well, I did get off the booze and drugs in March of 94, And life has really gotten better since then. It was kind of going down the crapper leading up to that time. But ever since, you know, I mean, it's exciting. I don't know what's going to, you know, what a day is going to bring. You never know. In 5 minutes, it could all change. It could get better. It could get worse. And, you know, it all doesn't matter. I just stay focused on the, what do they say, keep your eye on the prize. You know, I just want to keep getting better. You know, I have a certain empathy, or I don't know what the right word is. Paul Desmond was quoted one time as saying, yeah, I tried practicing for a while, and all it made me do was play faster. But, you know, I practice, man, every day I practice, and I just want to be more melodic. To me, it's all about, you know, playing trumpet. That's the melody instrument. Melodies is what speak to me. Well, melodies with great chords underneath it, and of course, great bass lines. But yeah, I want to be the most melodic player I can possibly be, and I focus a lot of my improvisation practice on just, you know, like the first thing I play, the first little few notes, I try to make the what comes right after that sort of line up with that, or, you know, like poetry, you know, you say one thing and the next thing rhymes. Or, you know, you have a consequent phrase and an antecedent phrase, you know what I'm trying to say? I want it to be conversational. To me, improvisation, if it's not conversational, it's you know, it's like, well, it's kind of like the way I'm talking, diarrhea of the mouth. You know, nobody wants to hear that, man. They want to hear, you know, some phrases. They want to hear something they can hang their hat on. They don't want to hear just, I don't think they do. I sure don't. Let's put it that way. All right. That was too long. Sorry.
No. You're good. So are you in New York, or are you in North Carolina now?
I've been in North Carolina since April of 2002.
Okay. So was a part of that, I mean, it had to be probably refreshing to hook up with Maynard after 9/11, because I remember that time period well. So was that probably a part of you getting out of New York City, was witnessing 9/11?
Yes and no. The amazing thing about New York, for about 2 weeks after that happened, everybody was so polite to each other, man. I've never seen New York. I mean, people, we loved each other. You know, we were all there for each other. The police weren't ticketing anybody. I didn't hear people screaming at each other on the street. You know, people weren't honking at each other. You didn't hear horns honking in the streets, you know. It was so different. But I needed to earn about $2,400 a month at that time to pay all my bills. And I had been doing that. I've been playing a lot of wedding dates, which were paying pretty well at the time. And they all dried up. And when I went on the road with Maynard, is it okay to talk about how much he paid?
Sure.
For a rookie, you got $400 a week before taxes. You had to find a way to provide one meal a day on days when you had a gig, and all your meals on days when you didn't have a gig. And then I was trying to send money home to my bank account. And by the time I got back to New York in, I guess it was November. No, it was December. I was running on empty. I had no gigs coming up. And like I said, you know, I was going broke. So, you know, I'd started my publishing company. The first books that I turned out were these duet books that I had written and had published by another publisher. So some people already knew about them. So between some of the trumpet community bulletin boards and stuff, I did sell a lot of those and was able to keep my head above water enough to move down here. And, it had something to do with 9/11, but, you know, basically it was more economics. And also I was trying to get, I had finished my master's degree at Manhattan School of Music, and I went back, you know, I was an old student. I went back, I guess I graduated when I was 45 years old. So I was trying to get teaching work, and, you know, New York is just saturated with great players and everybody's got a teaching gig. So I was sending resumes all over the place, and I was getting rejected all over the place. So, this girl, Janet, who is now my wife, she did not reject me. So I came down here, lived somewhere else, you know, for a year, and then we got married and I moved into her house, and, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
So talk to me a little bit about, you know, if you look at your career up to this point right now and you think about what you're the proudest of, what you've done in your career that makes you the happiest, what is that?
Well, I haven't given up. You know, trumpet, man. Trumpet is, you know, you have to stay with it. I do anyway. If I take there's an old saying. If I take one day off, I notice. If I take 2 days off, everybody notices. So I don't take any days off. So I'm really thrilled that I stuck with that. You know, the fact that I've written a lot of music that, you know, I put out a couple CDs in 2019. One of them did really well. I did a big band CD, and I was hoping that would do better. And I think it did okay, but the Baptism Funk Band Conspiracy CD, that did really well. And, you know, I still get compliments on that from time to time. So, you know, the fact, and that was all tunes that I wrote. The big band CD, we did old folks on it. You know, my little tip of the hat to Hank Mobley without even telling. Well, you're the first person I told that. People like my tunes, and that feels good. You know what I mean? Feels good when people like your tunes.
So let's say you have a dream tonight and you run into the younger version of yourself, say in your 20s or before you went to college or in college, and you could give that young version a piece of advice based on the wisdom you've gained throughout your life, your career as a musician. What would you tell your young version?
I would say booze and drugs are a dead end and you'll do much better without them. And don't take yourself so damn seriously, man. Life, you know, that's the other thing we did during COVID. My wife and I, we went somewhere every day. We just laugh, man. We have such fun. So, you know, laughter, humor, you know, stay positive, man. Don't let anything get you down. There's never any reason to panic. There really isn't. You just wait for the next thing to come along. Sometimes what you think is bad at the time, you look back, you know, a year later, it's like, oh, that could not have gone any better. So, you know, I need to just stay grateful for everything. Things that I think at the moment are not good often, invariably, turn out to be the best thing that could have happened. And you know, I don't plan any of this. You know, to me, it's like the God of my understanding is in charge. I'm not in charge of anything. And I kind of like it that way, man. It takes a big load off of me. So, yeah, and I know... I think God has the greatest sense of humor of anybody. I mean, he invented it, right? So, you know, I need to be able to see the bright side of things. I can't be down and gloomy and doomy and dismal. That's just, you know, that's counterproductive. You know, I'm trying to, what is it called? I'm a human being living a spiritual experience I'm a spiritual being having a human experience rather than a human being trying to have a spiritual experience. So, If I put things in perspective, yeah, there's no reason to take myself so seriously. There really isn't, man. I'm the best joke in town sometimes. The
bright
eye too, I'm sure. Yeah.
So everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your fans, but ultimately you're the one that's in control of your life. You live it. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
Well, I would hope that I'm a positive influence on other people. That's what I would hope. I can't control what anybody else thinks of me. I can, I actually get a kick out of irritating people, which is not really a good, habit or a good, thing to do. But sometimes it's funny, just, you know, you can tell something's getting under somebody's skin and you just try to, you know, irritate them a little more. So, I don't know if people knew that I was just trying to have fun, I think they would understand better that, you know, I basically love people, man. I love people. I don't hate anybody. I don't wish harm on anybody. But I think it's fun to, you know, like point out my own flaws and my own, you know, ridiculousness. And, you know, I would hope that other people kind of enjoy doing that too. But, you know, a lot of people don't. So I tread on thin ice very often when I, you know, sort of mess with people. I don't know. Yeah, this one band leader I work for, he always announces me. He says, "He's my pal, your pal, everybody's pal, Rich Willie." And I know he knows that. You know, I've had some some friction with some musicians because, yeah, I'll say things, you know, just having fun and people take it the wrong way. So, oh, well, what am I going to do, right? Come on, let's have some fun, man. That's my philosophy. Let's just have a good time. Life is too damn short to be gloomy and doomy. I've given you such long answers, man. I'm sorry about that.
No, you're good. You're good. You're filling in a lot of gaps of other questions that I could ask, so that's perfect. So, putting on the wrist, your books, anything else that you have revolving around your world, where's the best place for people to go to either buy, download, stream, or learn more about you?
Boptism.com/store. So Boptism, like the word baptism, except with the letter O, Boptism.com/store. Excuse me, Boptism. Came about, I wrote a tune based on the changes of Amazing Grace, excuse me, and I was listening to Hank Mobley, A Baptist Beat, and I was thinking, this tune needs some kind of a religious overtone since Amazing Grace, you know, is the foundation. So I named the tune Baptism. Excuse me. And so ever since I've been using the name Baptism as my, my trademark, shall we say. That was like in 81 or 82, I can't remember. Yeah, baptism.com/store. Long answer again.
Cool.
Sorry about that.
This has been great, Rich. Hey, thank you for opening up. Good luck with everything. I really appreciate your time. This has been fascinating.
Thanks, man. And I hope people listen to Holy Trinity and But for the Grace of God. Kind of putting the stake down that you know, I'm not a terrible person. I'm not a some jazz junkie. I'm actually a guy who's meaning to do the best in life and. Hopefully they think I have a good heart. You know, you can fool some of the people some of the time, right?
you can't do them all the time.
All right, thanks, sure. Joe. God bless.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in North Carolina, New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Rich for his time, music, and story. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com. And for everything Neon Jazz, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.